KZSU-FM Stanford, welcome to another edition of Hearsay Culture, the first edition of the summer quarter 2012. My name is Dave Levine. I'm an assistant professor at Elon University School of Law, as well as an affiliate scholar at the Center for Internet and Society at Stanford Law School. Today, I'm excited to have a return guest on the show after 4.5 years where he was last on the show. I'm very excited to have on Professor Brett Frischman of the Cardozo School of Law in New York. He is their director of IP and information law, and he is on discussing his book, which has just come out, Infrastructure, The Social Value of Shared Resources, from Oxford University Press. 4.5 years ago, Brett was on discussing an article that he had written regarding infrastructure and spillovers, and we'll talk a little bit about that by way of background in the beginning of our interview. But after all that time, and after the several years writing on a variety of topics involving these issues, Brett has come out with an extremely thorough but also readable version of this issue by focusing directly on what we mean by infrastructure and how we should manage it. And we're going to be talking about, jumping off, what infrastructure is, because this is a word which is not entered general, I think, conversation. It's not a household word. When we think about the variety of areas where Brett might say infrastructure is and what infrastructure is. So we're not just thinking about things like roads and bridges, or the energy grid or what have you. We're also thinking about things like the internet and telecommunications. All of these different services provided both by government and by the private sector or in partnership are infrastructures. And they're infrastructures that, as Brett points out, can be managed in a variety of ways. And in infrastructure, and the subtitle points to it, Brett makes the argument that there is merit to managing all of these infrastructures as what he will call them, we'll talk about as a commons, as a shared resource. And in order to get to that point, Brett has examined not only of several industries, but has gotten deep into economic theory, which we're going to be discussing a little bit on the show. But more broadly, what he develops is an overarching view of how we should think about these infrastructures. And we know, and information has entered the general marketplace with regard to the status of our infrastructure in the United States, and we'll talk about from the very beginning of the book, Brett posts a chart indicating a letter grade for a variety of infrastructures, and it's pretty scary stuff where you see an overall average grade for U.S. infrastructure, roads, bridges, energy, and so forth, of a D. And certainly anyone that gets a D in school, if they're serious, goes to their professor or their teacher and says, tell me what I did wrong. And so what this book does is point out what we're doing wrong. And from Brett's perspective, what that boils down to is mismanagement. And it's a mismanagement of these infrastructures by a failure to conceive what they could be and how they could be managed better. And this is a critical issue that we saw discussed in the last presidential election, we will talk about whether anything's been done about it since, but certainly something which will continue to be a problem, particularly as we put more stress on our infrastructure, as more and more people are attached to it and tethered to it in different ways. So I'm very excited to have Brett on. As I mentioned, he is a professor of law and director of the IP and Information Law Program at Benjamin Cardozo School of Law at Yeshiva. He's also co-author of Cyber Law, Problems of Policy and Jurisprudence in the Information Age, 4th edition, and he is a prolific author and speaker, and someone whose work I've admired from the moment that I became familiar with it 7 or 8 years ago, when I made the transition from practice into teaching and into academia. He is joining us via telephone from New Jersey, and I appreciate him taking the time today. So, Brett, thank you for joining us today on Hearsay Culture.
Oh, it's a pleasure to be here. Thanks. Great to be back.
Let's start off, for those that aren't familiar with your background, and we talked about this last time, but I think it's worth going into again. Chat a little bit more about your background and how you became interested in infrastructure.
Sure. So I was I suppose a good place to start is schooling, and so I was an astrophysics major in college. I went to grad school in engineering, and then I went on to law school at Georgetown. It was probably really my earlier astrophysics and engineering schooling sort of got me to think about things from a sort of functional systems-oriented perspective. But it wasn't really until law school where I started thinking about infrastructure policy more generally. And I suppose two papers I wrote as a law student actually got me started thinking about infrastructure. It's kind of funny to think back and think about law student seminar papers being sort of the origins of everything I'm doing today. But I think it's true. The first was for the Olin Workshop in Law and Economics, and it was sort of an overambitious paper aimed at rethinking the economics of U.S. science and technology policy. And I became intrigued, I think, by the many different ways that society promotes scientific and technological advancement. Government grants, tax policy, intellectual property laws, government procurement, and other things, and how these different kinds of institutions were kind of aimed at different types of things. Basic versus applied research, commercial innovation versus education, and so on. At the same time, there were a bunch of complex relationships between government and industry and academia that were also sort of interesting to think about. So in that paper, I started to see basic research itself as a type of infrastructure. It seemed to me that it was this foundational resource that sort of enabled all these other things to happen. And so that got me thinking in terms of infrastructure terms. I can trace back some of my thinking today and that comes up in this book back to that paper. And the second paper was focused on the Internet and its commercialization in the 1990s. And again, I was drawn to the bottom layers of the Internet and how they were effectively shared by many different types of users to do many different types of things. And here I started developing sort of a functional way of looking at these relationships, trying to think about the relationship between the Internet infrastructure and all of the stuff that it allowed people to do. And you know, there were other influences, too. I was working on a paper concerning lessons that could be learned from comparative analysis of environmental information and Internet commons. In a sense, throughout law school, I was kind of splitting my time between cyber law and intellectual property and, at the same time, environmental stuff. And to me, these things seem, these systems, these resource systems and the sort of the law or policy around that governed them, seemed related in some way. And this actually came with my job talk on the academic market. I don't know how long ago, it was about 12 years ago maybe. And so I started thinking about how, you know, people tend to think about each of these systems and the policy arenas or the law surrounding them in sort of independent silos, right? So I'm an environmental person. I think about environmental resources. I think about environmental law. And I kind of don't think about intellectual property. Same thing with intellectual property, same thing with the Internet. What seemed to me kind of interesting is to think about the functional similarities at that sort of the bottom layer that crossed all of those systems. So I think one way of conceiving of this book is it's about the bottom layer that cuts across a bunch of different silos. You know, and not just different silos in the context of telecommunications, but as well as other types of resources and environmental and information and so on. And I think it was really there when I started really thinking about trying to compare these different governance regimes. I started saying, well, you know, common carriage in telecom isn't so different from the idea expression, and this is going to sound a little crazy, but the idea expression in copyright law, mm-hmm. right? It's actually both of those kinds of doctrines create space for users to make use of certain fundamental resources in a non-discriminatory way. And so that, I guess that, I mean, we can dive more into that, I guess, as we're going forward, but that's kind of how at least I got started.
The focus of the book, of course, being infrastructure, you got into a bit here. I think a good jumping off point is we define some terms, and since you said a bit about broadly speaking what infrastructure is, I'll ask you more specifically. You identify in the book three characteristics, if you will, of infrastructure, and I think you know, before we get into detail about any of them, what are they?
The criteria. So before I get into the criteria, it might be worth just saying what infrastructure is.
Okay. Yeah. So that was kind of my another way of getting at it. So go ahead.
Criteria might just. It seems to me that that's where I ended up. But before I got there, thinking about how to think functionally about what is infrastructure. What I think of as infrastructure ends up being both over and under inclusive compared to what most people think of as an infrastructure. So it's usually, it might be helpful to start by saying, you know, what we think of conventionally, right? So the conventional approach would be to think about large-scale, human-made, physical resources. They're often, but not always, networks, right? And you mentioned a few of these in the intro, so mm-hmm. things like the electricity grid or the transportation network. Things that move other things around, allow us to move things around. The things that are being moved around might be information, they might be, you know, energy, it might be people, it might be cars, it might be things, you know, goods and services. But usually human-made, large-scale, physical. But if we even just think about those kinds of resources, those kind of traditional infrastructure, you know, they're usually open, shared, the public has access to them. We kind of rely on them all the time. But it's a bit under-inclusive, right? It doesn't include things like, as I meant, like basic research. Right? Basic research is not a physical resource. It doesn't include things like an ocean or Lake Michigan or the atmosphere, right? Because those environmental resources are not human-made, right? They're sort of natural. And so the conventional thinking about infrastructure didn't really, there's other infrastructural resources that sort of function very similarly to the road system or function very similarly to the electricity grid in terms of how we use them and how they allow us to do different things
mm-hmm.
From a functional perspective. And that's sort of what drove me to start thinking about, okay, well, you know, how do we sort of identify the resources that are functionally infrastructural, and I'll just call those things infrastructure. But note that my definition, these three criteria sort of arrived at, are over-inclusive in some sense, because they include basic research. They include things like environmental resources. They include things like ideas, where conventionally people wouldn't normally do that. So what are these three criteria? The three criteria sort of aim to define a sort of a set of resources that function a certain way. So the thing that this bottom layer across these different silos, I guess. And the three criteria, I'm going to sort of state them specifically and just say what they are, but we can kind of talk about what they mean, I guess.
Mm-hmm.
They're kind of technical, and they're drawn from sort of basic microeconomics. Okay, and there's three. The first is that the resource we're talking about can be consumed non-rivalrously for some appreciable range of demand.
Mm-hmm.
Right. The second is that the social demand for the resource we're talking about is driven primarily by the downstream productive activities that people, the things that people are doing with the resource. In other words, they're using the resource as an input to do other things. And then third, the resource can be used as an input into generating a wide range of different goods and services, which could include private goods and public goods and social goods.
And to be clear, when we talk about...
You can boil those down to think of it as a non-rival, shareable input that's generic or general purpose, right, that allows you to do lots of different things. It's not special purpose.
And I think it's important to note, just for those that are not focused on economics per se, when you say non-rivalrous, you mean that one's use or consumption of the resource doesn't prevent others from using it as well.
Right.
Yeah.
Right. Exactly. Right. So what non-rivalrous mean? So you can think of the easy way to get at that basic idea is to compare, ideas and apples. Right, so apples are rivalrous. I take a bite, and you can't. Right, the costs of you taking that bite that I just took are infinite. Right, because it's gone, it's been depleted, it's consumed. With an idea like the ideas we're talking about right now on the show, right, you can consume them, you can possess them, and the cost of all of your listeners also possessing and consuming, appreciating, getting some benefit from those ideas is zero.
Mm-hmm.
Right, zero versus infinite, right? Non-rival versus rival. And of course, there are some things like, like roads, or like lakes, that are what's called partially non-rival. They're sometimes rivalrous, they're sometimes non-rivalrous, right? If you're driving on the roadway at 2 a.m., right, there's no other driver, right, your consumption of the roadway is non-rivalrous. It doesn't affect, you know, the next person who wants to also drive on the roadway can, and you guys aren't congesting each other, right? But of course, as we all know, at 5 p.m. in the middle of rush hour, it can be highly congested. And so you've got a bunch of resources that are, on one hand, are non-rival, purely non-rival. They're always shareable at zero marginal cost, or sort of no additional cost for the next user. And then you've got a bunch of resources that are potentially shareable, but they're also potentially congestible, or potentially they run into these congestion problems or scarcity problems. But they don't necessarily. I mean, they could. Whether or not they do depends on how many people are using it,
right,
how much capacity you have, how you decide to manage the resource.
And that gets us, and we're chatting with Brett Frischman of Cardozo Law, author of the book Infrastructure, The Social Value of Shared Resources on KCSU FM Stanford and Hearsay Culture. Brett, yeah, that gets us to one other word that I want to define before we get into the meat of what you're talking about in the book. So what do you mean by commons?
Great question. Like infrastructure, commons is one of those words that means different things to different people. But let me be pretty clear. So commons are not things. They're not resources, right? Commons is a form of resource management or governance, right? It involves institutions. It involves sharing of specific resources or a specific resource or resources within a defined community. So you can think of when I refer to a commons, I'm referring to a resource management decision or institution where members of some community or group have decided to share a resource in a non-discriminatory way among those members. Now the thing is with infrastructure, the community tends to be the public at large. So if the public at large is sharing a resource in a non-discriminatory way, I would say that they're managing that resource as a commons. And there's a lot of other contexts in which commons involve communities that aren't the public at large, but are, you know, could be a faculty at a law school, or it could be a bunch of people collaborating on a research project, or, you know, it could be a smaller community, in which case it's not the public at large, and you talk about there can be members and non-members. So the basic idea for the purposes of this book is that commons, I define sort of commons management to refer to the function of the institution, which is non-discriminatory sharing of the resource.
When we're chatting about these issues, and in order, I think, to frame it from an on-the-ground perspective, because your book covers this issue, I think, quite well, both from a practical or policy perspective as well as from a theoretical perspective. If we think about, and you write about managing infrastructure as a commons, it is a stark reminder of where we are or how far we'd have to go to get there with reference to that table that you posted in the beginning, or that you published in the beginning of the book, and it's a report card for America's infrastructure that was put out by the American Society of Civil Engineers. And perhaps you could talk a bit about it, because the chart, as I mentioned, gives the U.S. an overall GPA of a D. It says that the estimated five-year investment need in order to presumably bring our infrastructure up to, but you can tell me, up to at least a C level, would be $2.2 trillion. And the numbers are frightening. A D for aviation, a C for bridges, prices, which, you know, in my cursory view, I thought was actually higher than I would have imagined. But you see things like roads get a D minus, levees, inland waterways, drinking water. There's a variety of wastewater. There's a variety of areas here which you all define as infrastructure. So perhaps looking at this chart with reference to what you write about, I'll ask you this question. What does a D mean in terms of the state of our current infrastructure?
Well, let me explain too why I included the chart.
Mm-hmm.
As you said, the American Society of Engineers developed this report card, and they do it on a semi-regular basis every couple of years. And it's on the quality of infrastructure across the nation, and it talks about key categories of infrastructure. It doesn't cover everything that in the book I would describe as infrastructure, but it covers many of the traditional things that the American Society of Civil Engineers focus on. And the grades are based on the physical condition, performance, available capacity, and needed fiscal investment for improvements. And, you know, there's certainly room to debate the specific grades. And any one of the types of infrastructure listed in the chart, one could argue about the grades and, you know, maybe push it up a minus or a plus. It's like students coming in complaining about their grades at the end of the semester, and you look at your grading sheet, and you could probably, if you really work hard, find a reason to move it up a half or down a half, but you know, our rule is that we don't. And, you know, you could do it, though, with respect to this. You could also argue about the grading process, and people could debate that. That's not really my task. My point with reference to this chart, and there are other studies I think that people could look to. My point is really just to highlight the problem, right? It's pretty well established that we have a bit of an infrastructure crisis in the United States, that we have underinvested in maintaining much of our infrastructure across the country over the past few decades, and that we're underinvesting in building the infrastructure for the future. And so the reason for including the report card is just to, you know, give the readers a visual and relatively easy to understand assessment, highlight the problem. And part of my goal in the book is not to fully diagnose each and every problem in each and every infrastructure industry. That would be impossible to do in the book. The goal in the book is to try to diagnose why it is that we take for granted the most important resources that we depend on every single day, right? The resources that if you think about any given day of your life, you think about the things you take for granted in going, you know, living a good life, right? Whether it's the roads, the clean air, water systems, electricity, the ideas and cultural heritage that form a part of who you are and also form, you know, the basis for educating your children. You know, you can go through that, and you just start to, why is it that these things we assume will be there for us in a condition and in a state that will allow us to do what we want to do in our lives, that they're going to be there, right? And there's this sort of, we take it for granted, I think, that they will be there, and yet there are lots of signs and lots of evidence that things are deteriorating. So we've experienced failures, right? Bridge failures, for example. And when we do, what do? We, as a society, it's a general phenomenon. We pay attention for a very short period of time, and then we move on, right? So, a bridge fails. What do? It gets enough attention, perhaps, to rebuild that particular bridge. Well, of course, you have to rebuild that particular bridge because the economy is devastated where that bridge failed. But do we systematically address the risk of failure across the nation? No. Mm-hmm. Right? We move on. Right? So more than 26% of the nation's bridges are still structurally deficient or functionally obsolete, according to the American Society of Civil Engineers. Right?
And let me just interrupt you quickly, Brandon. Just again, I recognize that you're not an engineer, but I just want to be clear about that. What this means, what the statistic means, is that, and correct me if I'm wrong, 1 in 4 bridges in the United States is at risk of collapsing. I mean, is that a significant risk of collapsing,
or is that going too far? To be more, it's not that every bridge that 1 in 4 is at risk of collapsing. No. Because there's some that are just functionally obsolete, but structural deficiencies suggest that they could be at risk. Mm-hmm. Right? That they require improvement to be functional, to meet safety standards, to meet our current needs.
Okay.
Right. Over 1 in 4 of our bridges are need significant investment, but not necessarily that they're at risk of collapsing at any given day or something. That, mm-hmm. that would be even worse. But no, that's.
But that, okay, so it doesn't quite mean that.
Right.
Okay.
Right. But my point is that a bridge fails, right? And what is the public attention is drawn to fixing that particular bridge, but we don't systematically think about bridges. We just focus on the particular failure. We address it in time. We're reactive rather than proactive, right? And this is symptomatic to lots of infrastructure problems, infrastructure industries, and it's true with respect to you can think about Hurricane Katrina and the levees, right? So we address the particular, but we don't think systematically about how to address. I mean, it's not that there aren't people thinking about it, but as a society, we're not willing to do what it takes, perhaps, to address the problem. Now, what it takes is a bigger question than I try to address in this book. Mm-hmm. Right? I don't try to prescribe, like, do we want, you know, the federal government, or do we want state governments, or do we want to rely entirely on private companies or industry or, you know, public-private partnerships. There's lots of different ways to approach different types of problems in different kinds of infrastructure industries. And the goal of the book is not to prescribe how to address each and every problem across the board. Point, what the book is trying to do is illustrate and explain why it is that we take them for granted, why these things are, the social value of these resources is so high and so important, and then sort of focus on sort of some discrete things that we could do in terms of sort of solutions in particular contexts.
We're chatting with Professor Brett Frischman of Cardozo Law on KZCU-FM Stanford and Hearsay Culture, discussing his new book, Infrastructure, The Social Value of Shared Resources. For those of you that listen to KZSU regularly, you know that KZSU is a nonprofit, non-commercial radio station at Stanford University that requires donations from listeners like you to continue its diverse programming. For those of you that haven't listened regularly, recognize that while you may be listening to this show via podcast, show does air originally on KZSU, and KZSU has been the home of Hearsay Culture since its inception, now over 6 years ago. For those of you that like to make a donation to KZSU, you can email our underwriting department at underwriting@kzsu.stanford.edu. Again, underwriting@kzsu.stanford.edu. Or you can go to our website at kzsu.stanford.edu and click on Donate to KZSU. And I should also note, and I say this public service announcement every show, but to just underscore this point, the long form interview and detailed interview that we do on Hearsay Culture is one that KZSU has supported from its inception. It's as you know, not the general format for commercial radio, and so it's equally important to recognize that is the format of nonprofit, non-commercial radio that allows for shows like Hearsay Culture to exist, and which is why my loyalty to KZSU remains as strong as it always has. And why I do encourage you to make that donation, because KZSU does support this kind of programming, which is exceedingly difficult or impossible to do in most other models. Indeed, in most other models of, if you will, telecommunications infrastructure. Having said that, regardless, I hope you continue to listen to the show. Brett, let's come back to that point you were just making, and I think it gets us to this. So, what do we do? issue, but without getting into, as you said, specifics of what the policy might look like, because your book is designed to force policymakers, I think, to rethink how they think about infrastructure as opposed to then issuing specific policy prescriptions. And so if we take your conception of how infrastructure should be managed seriously, the subtitle of your book is The Social Value of Shared Resources. So let me ask you to define one more term for those that aren't familiar before I ask you the follow-up question, which is what this would look like, not again in specifics, but broadly. What do you mean by the social value? What is social value for purposes of infrastructure management?
Well, that's a good question. So that it also allows me to tie back to the previous question, something
right.
I had meant to say.
Mm-hmm.
So when you're thinking about solving these problems about bridge failures or about sort of investment needs in different areas, you can think of that as sort of a supply side problem, right? How are we going to go about supplying the infrastructure we need, directing investment to supply the stuff that we need? The book's orientation is on the demand side. So the book's orientation is about, as you just pointed out, it's about social value, trying to understand why it is that society demands infrastructure, why it is that we need infrastructure, how it creates value for the public at large. It's not really exactly about the supply side, except in certain instances where I talk about how the demand and the supply side interact with each other. There are loads and loads and volumes of books in economics and other fields about the supply side issues. That's why I don't go into those, because there's in engineering and economics, there's just plenty of, that's where the attention is. My attention is on the demand side, because that's where I think there's an absence of careful attention to the value side, why it is that we demand infrastructure. And so when I'm talking about the social value of shared infrastructure, social value is the trick or the difficulty is that the value in a typical economic analysis of an infrastructure resource, the demand is assumed to be what people are willing to pay for it. So you line up the potential users of the infrastructure, you think about the prices they're willing to pay for access and use of the infrastructure, you sum that up, and that tells you, I'm not going to get into the details of constructing a demand curve and all that stuff, but
right.
The idea is...
That's for people that buy the book.
The demand for... I'm sorry.
I just said that's for people that buy the book.
Yeah, that's in the book.
Yeah.
But the conventional way of thinking about the demand side, and this is why there's not a whole lot of attention to given to it, is to think about, well, consumers, you know, users, consumers' willingness to pay for infrastructure, that tells us what the demand is. So we just need to know if we're building a bridge or we're building roads or we're investing in basic research, who the potential users are and what they'd be willing to pay, and we can estimate that. And that'll tell us what the value is. And then we just got to figure out how best to supply whatever it is that we're talking about. The book suggests that is a very narrow and distorting way to think about the value of these kinds of resources, because the society actually demands these resources to a level in a way that's very different from just what the users or the consumers' demand would suggest. And the reason why is that, again, because infrastructure are shareable inputs, and they're inputs into productive activities by users, users are often generating value that is represented by their willingness to pay, right? So as a user of a road, let's say, or the electricity grid, I derive direct value because, and that's why I choose to use it. That's why I'm willing to pay to use it. But if I'm using that infrastructure productively and I'm producing private, public, or social goods, right, in particular when I'm producing public or social goods, which again are sort of terms of art and economics, and the book goes into these in detail. I assume we won't want to get into too much detail here. But when you're producing public and social goods, you're generating value not just for yourself as a user of the infrastructure, but also for others, for third parties. Right, so here's one example. You know, when people blog or use the internet infrastructure, to engage, to create Wikipedia or to blog about some political issue. Right? They generate value for other people, third parties, some of whom are also online reading the blog or the Wikipedia page, but also people offline. My grandmother benefits when people in her community are identifying a problem in their, some issue in their community and resolving it to her benefit, even though she's not actually a participant in that particular discussion online. Right? The infrastructure enables people to produce public and social goods that benefit themselves, but also that benefit others. Right? So the social value of infrastructure, particularly infrastructures that allow users to engage in activities that benefit themselves but also benefit others because they're generating public and social goods, right? The social value is more than what the market value is. It's different from what the market value is, the market value being what people are willing to pay for it. And so much of the book really unpacks what I've just sort of said very quickly in a minute. Much of the book unpacks that in sort of elaborate detail, trying to illustrate the many different ways in which lots of these infrastructure that we take for granted generate benefit not just for the immediate user, but also generate value for others. And so I've written a bunch about this, both in, it's in the book, but it's also elsewhere. It's, mm-hmm. You could think of it in terms of spillovers or externalities as well.
Why don't you, for benefit of the listener, who is getting their head around this idea, can you give me a concrete example of that phenomena in action? One that illustrates this point, recognizing correctly that in an hour long interview, we certainly can't get into the level of detail that you do in the book to support this proposition.
Right. Well, even give you an example of using an infrastructure to generate social value.
Yeah, correct.
The user gets.
Yeah, and to be clear, I mean, your book discusses the whole idea of infrastructure in a way that has not been seen much before. So perhaps a counterintuitive example would be even better.
Okay, a counterintuitive.
if there is one.
Example.
Well, I guess it's difficult to ask counterintuitive to someone who spends their career focusing on the issue, but if you put yourself in the shoes of someone thinking about this issue for the first time, is there one that you think would come as a surprise to someone becoming familiar with this area?
Well, I mean, there's examples of, you use the, and Carol Rose, a legal scholar who was at Yale at the time, wrote some a great article about the comedy of the commons, and she talked about how road systems, early on, so the use of road systems, open use of the road systems led people to increasingly engage in commerce with people from, so it increased the scope of markets, and increased the scope of social interactions among communities and communities that were geographically distant, right? And so when using the road to engage in commerce can generate spillovers or positive third-party effects above and beyond the people who are engaged in that particular, beyond the amount of value that the people engaged in the transaction are able to capture. In part because it increases the scope of commerce, but also in part because it enables socialization across communities. So people are actually talking to, engaging with different cultures or people from different backgrounds. It allows the exchange of ideas, and those ideas sort of perpetuate and sort of work their way through broader and broader sort of range of communities. So you might think that's an example of, using the roads in a way productively to not only to engage in commerce, but also engage in these other kinds of activities that generate value more broadly. Building, so in the book I talk about in terms of certain kinds of social goods, one of the types, I talk about four different types, but one of the types is social capital. Right, and social capital is incredibly valuable in terms of cementing certain kinds of relationships, allowing people to trust each other and do things over the medium to long run that they might not otherwise be able to do. And so using roads actually helps people develop social capital as they're going from point A to point B or from city A to city B in ways that are actually valuable above and beyond just the value that the person who's immediately deciding whether to drive from A to B what they're able to capture or that they recognize. You know, there are examples in the book. I mean, one of the examples that often I use to illustrate sort of this is you can think of sort of YouTube videos. It's a nice one, right? Mm-hmm. The internet and YouTube itself are sort of the internet's an infrastructure, but also there is the internet infrastructure itself the networks that allow you to to transmit data. But also you can think of YouTube as an infrastructural platform that allows people to post user-generated videos. Right, and so lots of people post videos, like I post a video of my three boys dancing and doing something funny. I may send it to, I may generate the video and post it on YouTube and send a link to my 30 friends and family or something and expect, you know, that's the value I'm getting, that's what I'm the value I'm capturing by engaging in that activity that YouTube and the internet allow me to do. But you know, it may be that 100 or 150 people actually go and watch that video and laugh and cry and whatever because they enjoy some small benefit from seeing that. So I've engaged in the activity, generate a value above and beyond what I capture, that sort of this small scale spillover. The thing that's interesting about YouTube is that millions of people do that. Right? So if millions of people post videos expecting very small personal benefit but at the same time generating benefits for others, you've got a sort of a vehicle for generating social value that's quite interesting. Right? So I don't know if that's a...
No, I think it is.
An intuitive example you were looking for.
Well, I think it is because you know, I think from a top level, you know, thinking about a service like that as part of our infrastructure, I think in and of itself is a valuable contribution because as you mentioned in the beginning, these various, goods and services, tend to be viewed in isolation rather than as something, managed more holistically. Which really gets us, you know, and again, we have about 10 minutes left, which is the unfair portion of the show where I ask you questions that you can't answer in the time that you have, although perhaps this entire topic is one that begs for a 3-hour interview, which Brett, perhaps you can be the first person to attempt that route. But we have an hour today and about 10 minutes left. Let me jump ahead a little bit and ask you again, recognizing that you're not making policy prescriptions in this book per se, but I'm curious to get a top level answer. There's an ongoing debate. In fact, I think it's an increasing debate going on about the role of government.
Can I interrupt you for a second?
Oh yeah, sure, yeah.
There are policy prescriptions in the book. They're just not policy prescriptions about how best to supply infrastructure
across
all different categories.
Right, right.
In other words, I don't deal with the how we should solve the failing bridge crisis, how we should direct investment to bridges and roads and every other place. There's in the chapter about roads, I talk about I talk about congestion pricing and how congestion pricing can be an attractive policy in various contexts. I also have in chapter 13 about the internet network neutrality. I propose a very specific network neutrality rule and sort of talk about that at the policy prescription. So there are policy prescriptions. They're just I just wanted to be very careful earlier on to say that you know I'm pointing to a major problem in infrastructure. We underinvest. We undersupply. We mismanage. And then I want to identify part of the reason why we have this systematic problem is that we undervalue, we don't appreciate social demand or the social value of infrastructure across the board, but I can't, it's impossible to do in a single book. That alone, what I just described, takes an entire book to do. I can't fully diagnose like, in each and every area how best to supply it.
Right.
There are policy prescriptions, but they have more to do with non-discriminatory management of infrastructure. And not about how best to supply it.
A fair point, and the reason I was giving that caveat is because my question is going to get directly to that broader who does it type question, which I wanted to caveat by saying that isn't a focus of the book. But I appreciate the clarification. So let me ask the question quickly this way: in terms of getting at that value. In thinking about this as a government versus private sector scenario, though again partnerships are increasing, do you have a perspective on whether the government or private sector or working in tandem perhaps would be best at capturing that idea. And in other words, taking this theoretical conception that you lay out at the book and actually implementing it. Do you have a view at a top level whether government versus the private sector or both might be better, generally speaking, to address these problems?
No, is the simple answer. Because recognizing the social value of infrastructure is something that's got to happen both in the private and the public sector, and it's got to happen at the level of individuals, right? Even, you know, individuals have to, as citizens, we have to recognize that we need to have a strong public commitment to supporting infrastructures that we all rely on daily. In terms of dealing with, you know, so in the book I talk about, so the book is very much about sort of the social value of shared infrastructure, and part of the where I do get into prescriptions is about the sharing aspect, the commons, or the non-discriminatory management of infrastructure, to maintain the infrastructure's sort of generic, general-purpose nature, and to support the user production of public and social goods. And in the chapter dealing with the commons management idea, I talk about why, you know, in some cases, private actors who own the infrastructure it's good strategy on their own behalf to manage the infrastructure in an open, non-discriminatory way. And so in some cases, private owners will do that, in which case the case for the government involvement is quite weak. In other cases, however, and I sort of talk about what these cases might look like, the case for government intervention to impose a commons management rule or non-discrimination rule, and there's a variety of different ways in which the government might do that. The case for public government intervention to do that with respect to privately owned infrastructure can be quite strong. And so there's, in some cases where we're talking about privately owned infrastructure that supports public and social goods, the case for intervention needs to be evaluated. Then throughout the second half of the book, I have to go through a bunch of different examples, different sectors. And so when we're talking about roads, for example, right, over 90% of the roads in the U.S. are publicly owned, right, publicly provided, although they're often sort of managed and sustained by private entities under contract. But when the actual resource is publicly owned and provided, right, commons management isn't really – you don't need government intervention to impose commons. Commons is sort of a natural consequence. Everyone gets access to the roads on more or less equal terms. The policy issues there have to do with how to deal with congestion and environmental problems that arise on the roads, for example, and then to sort of maintain investment incentives. The next chapter turns over to telecom and says, look, in telecom, the story is a little different because they're privately owned infrastructure. And so then the case for government intervention to impose a commons management rule, sort of in the form of common carriage or interconnection rule sometimes, right, it looks a bit different because you're starting with a privately owned infrastructure. And then the question is, okay, if the case for government, for a commons management rule makes sense, how are we going to go about implementing it? Right, so the role of private and public is mixed. And also, I mean, in general, sometimes it's a bit of both, right? It's very, very hard. A lot of time in discourse about government and markets is just this false dichotomy of there's a binary. It's either government or it's market, or it's, you know, it's just black and white, market versus government stuff, public versus private. But in reality, and this is part of the lesson from the commons literature and Eleanor Ostrom, who just passed away a few weeks ago, but had won the Nobel Prize, has been awarded the Nobel Prize in economics a few years ago for her work on commons institutions. It's not just public-private, government-market, right? There's lots of other third options. There's intermediate solutions or hybrid solutions. And if you really look carefully, the reality is that almost everything's a hybrid. Now, there's no such thing as a purely private free market. Right? Every market you can point to involves will heavily rely on different forms of governance and government and sort of structuring it. So I guess I'm sort of fighting the question to some degree because I think it's actually, it turns out to be much more complicated, and it just depends upon the context that you're analyzing.
Well, no, well, look, and that's part of why I asked the question the way I did, because, you know, it is complex, and yet, policymakers, I think, and I agree with you, tend to, view these issues, and certainly commentators often view it as an either or. However, and this is unfortunately, like I said, it's an unfair portion of the show, but however, there are very differing values and value structures that are baked into how the private sector would, you know, thinks about a given issue versus government. I think we've seen that over the last few weeks in the handling of the ouster and now reappointment of the president of the University of Virginia, apparently, you know, originally ousted by a board of advisors made up of private sector individuals who apparently were thinking about UVA more as a business, a profit-making business, than as a nonprofit educational institution. Again, that is a can of worms that I merely throw that bomb and not even ask you to respond to it. Although I will say if you want to give a quick response, you can. But suffice to say that no, I think that dichotomy is false and yet is one paramount in people's minds. So I'm doing a roundabout way of saying I think you have answered the question. Brett, in the last, or do you want to respond quickly, or?
Well, I won't, but in detail about the UVA situation in particular, I will comment on it. I mean, and I've written about this elsewhere, the idea that, you know, there is sometimes a confusion about mission and what the guiding criteria are in terms of decision making in a variety of different institutions. So it's not a surprise that when a for-profit corporation is going to make certain decisions that maximize profit, that's exactly what we want. That's the, I think in general, I mean, some people will critique that point, but I think in general, that's the point of relying on private actors that are for-profit companies. But we have to recognize that they can't do everything. And when we're talking about universities, right, profit-making is not the central mission. Right, and same thing with when you're talking about government and other kinds of institutions. So I think you're right. I mean, I think there's just a, but that's not necessarily a purely an infrastructure question.
Right, of course.
It's a more general question about the decision-making frameworks and values that are sort of inherent in the frameworks that we're adopting in different institutions.
And that's where I think, you know, and again, you know, to close on that point, I mean, that's where I think the book's contribution is valuable in forcing policymakers to think more holistically about the value of infrastructure beyond, as you pointed out, what it's going to do for me tomorrow or even right now, but what it's going to look like 2 or 3 years from now and how it might be underutilized. Brett Frischman, author of the book Infrastructure, The Social Value of Shared Resources, thanks for being on the show. As I picked up the book, I noted the price of the book, which is priced at a number more typical of academic oriented books, although I think the book is aimed and certainly is valuable to a much wider audience than merely professors and other academics in the field. So, you know, with that precursor, I'm curious, for those people that want to learn more about your work or even have access to this book, I know that you had mentioned to me that a paperback version will be coming out in the near future. How else can people access Infrastructure short of purchasing the book outright?
Well, let me just say, it is priced high. That has not, I had no real say ultimately in the price. I wish it was priced at, you know, $10. So, I mean, I would like to maximize my readership more than I care about selling, you know, books exactly. I know. But, you know, that's just the way the publishing industry works.
Mm-hmm.
So two thoughts. One is, yes, I hope the paperback will come out in the spring and it'll be priced more in the, you know, $30 to $40 range, and hopefully that will make it more attractive for some. Two, if people are, you know, go to Amazon or Barnes & Noble or wherever and click the I want to see this as Kindle, I want a Kindle version. Right? They ask you that on each of those pages, I know you. I want a Nook version. Click, you know, say, I want to see this in Nook. I want to see this in Kindle, because I've been trying to push to have that done as soon as possible to get it out to a broader audience. I'm going to post chapters on SSRN to get make some of the chapters accessible. SSRN.com is a social science research network where you can freely download papers, and I'm going to put a bunch of the chapters up there, as many as I can, to make them accessible. I think you're right. I mean, the book is is an academic book in a sense, but it's also one that I think, you know, is should be read or could be read by a wide range of people, you know, from people on the Hill to people who are interested in policy issues, in intellectual property, in internet space, but also in other areas of infrastructure, environmental policy. It crosses a bunch of different areas and hopefully gets people to sort of appreciate some of the cross-cutting and important similarities in policy issues that arise across a bunch of the major kinds of resources that we depend on a daily basis.
Well, it's that diverse target audience that encouraged me and certainly made me think that this would be a great topic, again, for Hearsay Culture. So Brett Frischman, professor at Cardozo Law, author of the book Infrastructure to Social Value of Shared Resources. We're recording, by the way, on June 28. Thank you for joining us today on Hearsay Culture. I greatly enjoyed the discussion. I look forward to having you back for a 3-hour or at least another hour version to further get into the ideas that you put forth in your book.
My pleasure. I look forward to a 3 to 5 to 8 hour discussion.
There we go. As do I'm sure every listener of Hearsay Culture. So I'm going to close today rather quickly by saying that I am as I'm recording the show in late June, I am finalizing the guest schedule for the coming quarter, and I will be posting that. In fact, by the time the show airs, I will have posted it on hearsayculture.com. So I will simply say thank you for listening today to Hearsay Culture, this first interview of the summer quarter 2012. I hope you've enjoyed the discussion. Please stay tuned to KZSU for more diverse programming, and have a great day.